We're going to get started. The Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight will come to order. We don't yet have a quorum, but we're going to get started so we can stay on time here. Representative Hartman, I'm going to have you start with House File 267. You can describe the bill and have your testifiers get started, and as soon as we have a quorum, we'll interrupt you and move the bill. Representative Hartman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. The bill that I have before the committee today is House File 267. What the bill would do is it would change Minnesota law with regard to child passenger restraint. Right now, you are required to have your baby in a car seat and your child in a booster seat up to age 4. What this bill would do is it would extend the protection to children up to age 8. What we would do is we would require a proper child passenger restraint system for children up to the age of 8. And the reason for this is that children who are under 8 years old or under 4'9" do not get adequately protected by the seatbelts that are in cars that are created for adults. With me today is Gail Weinholzer from AAA.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
I'm Gail Weinholzer, Director of Public Affairs for AAA Minnesota, Iowa. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I wanted to start out by sharing with you some of the materials that have been provided in your packets. The first is a brochure that was produced by Safe Kids Minnesota. It has a lot of the key statistics that surround this issue. The second is a guest editorial that outlines exactly why this bill is necessary to protect children under the age of 8. Then we've got the guest editorial from the Star Tribune endorsing this legislation. We've got a map of the United States that shows you that 44 other states do a better job of protecting our youngest passengers than we do. And then the Department of Public Safety pulled their crash facts for 2008 that show nearly 15% of those children in this age group involved in a crash were actually in a booster seat. And it also shows the effectiveness of those booster seats that 84% were completely uninjured. So I'd encourage you to take a look at those handouts during the appropriate parts of our testimony today. AAA is leading a broad-based coalition of organizations that are in support of this legislation, from the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, to the medical community, to the enforcement community, and some of those folks will be here testifying on behalf of their organizations today. But I'm here on behalf of our 700,000 Minnesota members, nearly 80% of which support this legislation, and I wanted to be their voice during this hearing today. Child passenger safety is a top legislative priority for us in Minnesota, which, as I mentioned, has one of the weakest laws in the entire nation. 44 other states do a better job protecting our youngest passengers than we do. Our current restraint law is more than 26 years old. It was written before booster seats existed and before adequate research was done as to how to protect children in vehicles. All we're asking the legislature to do is to update and modernize a current statute. We're not asking for new legislation. We just feel that this legislation is out of date and too weak and needs to be modernized in order to be useful and serve a purpose in protecting our youngest passengers. Our nation's transportation system and the vehicles that travel on them were not developed with children in mind. Seatbelts are designed to restrain adults. An improperly positioned seatbelt will ride up over the neck and stomach of a child rather than the shoulders and the hips. Without that seatbelt going over the proper parts of the body, you'll have severe intestinal injuries and potentially spinal cord injuries. And Dixie Duncan is here today to speak on behalf of her daughter and her family to relate that story to you.
We officially have a quorum, so I formally call this meeting to order. Go ahead.
In Minnesota, our current law says under age 4, you have to be in a child restraint device. But after age 4 and through age 10, you merely need to be restrained in an adult seatbelt. Current legislation gives parents the wrong impression. It lets them believe that after age 3, a child is properly restrained in an adult seatbelt. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Children's Hospital of Philadelphia has done extensive research over the past decade that shows that a child between the ages of 4 and 7 in a booster seat is 59% less likely to be injured in a crash and 28% less likely to die in that crash. And as I mentioned, if you look at the 2008 Department of Public Safety statistics, you can see that there were absolutely no fatalities with a child in this age group using a booster seat. In fact, 84% of the children in that age group walked away uninjured. At AAA, we conduct car seat clinics across the state of Minnesota, and inevitably, the first question that we're asked by parents is, what does the law say? Since parents are looking to the law for guidance, we must be sure that the information we provide represents best practice and not standard from 26 years ago. Additionally, if you'll notice in your automobile car owner's guide, it will also point to state statutes as the proper guideline for restraining adults and children in vehicles. AAA Minnesota Iowa Breeze Education is an important part of this issue, and we've spent more than the last decade working with parents and caregivers across the state, educating them on the importance of this issue. In fact, 2 years ago, the Department of Public Safety did a survey that asked parents if they understood the various types of child restraint devices and the importance of them, and 90% did understand. Unfortunately, as I pointed out in the 2008 Crashback, nearly 15% are actually using them. Therefore, a second component, along with education, needed to prevent child passenger injuries and deaths, is an enhanced traffic safety law. For this component, we need your help and your vote. I want to dispel just two misunderstandings about this legislation before I conclude. First, this is not about ticketing parents or caregivers. In fact, in the previous committee, Representative Holberg made a motion that the fine must be waived within 14 days if a parent or caregiver produces proof of acquiring an appropriate child restraint device. So this is not intended in any way to be punitive. And secondly, it's not a fundraising mechanism for the state of Minnesota. Less than $25,000 was collected across the entire state last year. And in fact, that money goes into a special fund at the Department of Public Safety that's used to train child passenger safety technicians across the state, and it's used to provide low-income families with the necessary car seat or booster seat that they may need that they don't have the financial assistance for. I urge you on behalf of our membership to vote in favor of this legislation. Again, all we're doing is asking you to update a current Minnesota state statute and modernize it to the level of best practice. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, but we have other testifiers, and the next one will be Dixie Duncan, a mother from the Moorhead area.
Questions from members? Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And testifier, I'm curious as to the 44 other states, what's the range in ages that they use ages?
Yes, they do.
Ms. Weinhold.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Jackson. They do have a range in ages. The other 44 states have a minimum of under 6, which would be a 2-year enhancement over our current state statute, up to under 9, which a couple of states have as well. Some have added in a height component because that's important to bone structure with a child. A child at 4 feet 9 inches tall is approximately the age of 8, and therefore their bone structure is at the point that they can use an adult seatbelt without injury. But there is a range from under 6 to under 8 based on the other 44 states.
Representative Owen.
I have a follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a follow-up on the question that was asked by Representative Jackson, and that's specifically when you look at North Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin, that touch upon us, what is their age that they use and what height restrictions?
Ms. Weinhold.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rowland. I brought a map with me. Wisconsin is under 8. Illinois is under 8. Iowa is under 6. North Dakota is under 7, and South Dakota is one of the 6 states, along with Minnesota, that only restrains under 4.
Follow-up, Representative Owen.
One quick follow-up, thank you. What height do they use? Do they use the same height, or is their height varying considerably too?
Ms. Weinhold.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Owen. Very few states use anything other than age, but those that do, when they use a height, use 4 feet 9 inches tall, because that's the appropriate height for a child to be properly restrained and have the seatbelt, again, riding over the shoulder and the hip rather than the stomach and the neck.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, Representative Hortman, who's next? Oh, Representative Mullen, sorry to be late.
Madam Chair, Weinhofer, you said it's the proper height for the restraint and not that the shoulder harness or whatever for an adult doesn't work. Why do you distinguish between somebody who's 8 and somebody who's 10 who is the exact same body?
If it's
a matter of how they fit the restraints.
Ms. Weinholzen.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, underage has been used as a standard for a couple of reasons. One, and I think one of our pediatricians that will testify later can also touch on this. At age 8 is typically the size that a child is at 4 feet 9 inches tall. Age 8 has also been the number that's been used for incentive grants to NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and the height variance we use so that if perhaps a 6-year-old reaches 4 feet 9 inches tall, they would no longer be required to use the child restraint device. So those are the issues that we typically use, the reasons why we typically use the age under 8.
Representative Mullery, follow-up. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Weinholzer, what state was the first one to put this law into effect?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, it was approximately 20 years ago, almost 30 years ago, actually, just celebrated the 30th anniversary of the first child restraint law, and I don't recall exactly which was the first state, to be honest with you, Representative. I believe it was either Kentucky or Tennessee, but I'm not entirely sure.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Weinholzer, do you have some, maybe you get this to me afterward, some of the results, the effects of having this law put in place in Kentucky and Tennessee and these other states that have the law, and so what basis do you compare, what are the results of having the law in effect in those states based on... you give us some statistics here in this AAA deal from Burnsville this is what's going to happen, but I don't see any actual data.
Ms. Weinholzer.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, two things on that issue. One, states that have enhanced the child passenger restraint law have seen an increase in compliance by over 49%. And secondly, as I pointed out with the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia research, that a child in an appropriate child restraint device during this age frame is 59% less likely to be injured and 28% less likely to die.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Weinholzer, please give me some data.
Sure.
I need some results. There's nothing black and white here right now.
All right. Thank you. All right. And next, testifier.
Hi, Madam Chair. Our next testifier is Dixie Duncan.
Please come to the table and state your name for the record.
My name is Dixie Duncan. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dixie Duncan. I'm the mother of Brim. I'm here to be the voice of my little girl, who is also here with us today. We felt that it was important for Brim and her sisters to see state law in action and how our voice can make a difference. Our hope for Brim and our family's prayer is that you hear the story and vow that no more children in Minnesota will have to endure what she went through this fall and what she will have to live with for the rest of her life. Brynn is a spunky, tenacious 8-year-old. She never walked. She ran, skipped, and jumped wherever she went. Like most kids her age, she loved sports and playing with friends. However, on August 18, 2008, Brynn's life changed in an instant. On a last-minute school shopping trip with her grandmother, Brynn was not using a booster seat she usually rode in our vehicles. She was restrained with only a seatbelt, since that was all that the law required. Because the adult seatbelt did not fit properly, the lap portion rode up on her hips and onto her stomach. Brynn had placed the shoulder strap of the portion adult shoulder strap behind her back, as children her age mostly do, to prevent it from going into her face. The vehicle she was riding in was involved in a car accident, car crash in the Fergus Falls area. According to the paramedics first on the scene, Bryn was found unconscious with her head between her knees. The impact caused Bryn's upper body to fly forward violently. Because the shoulder portion of the seatbelt was not in place, her spinal cord was permanently severed at the waist. Because the lap portion of the seatbelt was not on lower on her hips, her internal organs were catastrophically damaged. In addition to her spinal cord injury, she had a severed intestine, a bruised heart, a partially paralyzed diaphragm, and a damaged kidney. While in emergent surgery, Bryn's kidney, appendix, and gallbladder were removed. In addition, Bryn suffered immense pain, depression, severe fevers, and infections. Weeks went by as survival laid in the balance. She spent close to 2 months at Hennepin County Medical Center, the majority of the time that she was in the ICU. Her intestines were in such shock, she was not able to tolerate any food for months, and when she did, the eating of it was very painful and unbearable. According to Dr. Andrew Carrago, Bryn's doctor at HCMC, her most serious injuries were unfortunately caused by the improper placement of the seatbelt. The medical term for this seatbelt is called seatbelt syndrome. After a time of great depression and tears, the spark did come back into her eyes. She was able to sit up. She had to learn how to dress herself again and transfer into a wheelchair. Bryn came back, but the ability to feel and move her legs did not. She will be paralyzed for the rest of her life. She spent another month in rehabilitation and is now back at home in Moorhead and back at school. However, she still requires around-the-clock care to be sure her bowels and bladders function correctly. I often get up a couple times in the evenings and in the overnights to attend to her needs. We were unable to stay in our current home as it was too small for Bryn to wheel even into the bathroom. The whole town of Moorhead and the surrounding communities have rallied behind Bryn, and with fundraisers and due to the kindness of others, a new house is being built for us. When I was asked to help promote this law to require booster seats, I stated that we wanted to do more to help other families and to help to prevent this. I had previously recognized the lack of support a normal seatbelt provided Bryn. I had made sure Bryn regularly sat in a booster. However, on the day of the crash, a quick shift of plans resulted in a transfer of Bryn going into Grandma's truck. When the booster seat was not present, had it been state law, Bryn would have never gone without. If it had been state law, we would have automatically had the booster seat with us. State law required Bryn to be buckled, and that saved her life. But the booster seat law would have saved her from a spinal cord injury and extensive internal injuries. We have agreed to have her story told so that no one more child will suffer through the injuries that she has experienced. She's once again a spunky and tenacious child who loves school and sports. She has just had a few new ways to participate, but there are still those hard days. Like the day when we moved out of our house, Bryn said to us, "It's all because of me that we have to move." Or the day she cries when she comes home after watching her friends run and skip in class, in gym class. But together with her, our faith, and the love and support of our community, Bryn will thrive. I've heard the arguments against this law. Some parents don't like the laws that tell them how to transport their children. Others think having the booster seat for their kids up to the age of 8 would be a hassle. They cannot imagine having to get their child to use one or spend $15 if they need one. Bryn's family says booster kit for Bryn is a small hassle, but the safety they provide outweighs any time or money spent using them in comparison to what we are dealing with and the cares we have now. Please pass this law to keep the children in Minnesota safe. Pass this law for Bryn.
Thank you. Questions from members? All right, seeing none, next. Representative Portman.
Madam Chair, our next testifier is Officer O'Neill.
Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Officer Kevin O'Neill.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm a police officer with the City of Lakeville Police Department. I've been a police officer for over 16 years. And over the years, many of my duties have revolved around specialized assignments in traffic safety and community programs, including child passenger safety programs. I'm also the father of four small children, and I can assure you that I have lots of practical experience with car safety seats as such. Professionally, I do spend a considerable amount of time helping members of our community with car seat checkups and child safety seat clinics. I also speak to parent groups, daycares, and schools on the topic of child passenger safety. Through these contacts, I've learned that to many people, our state statute can be somewhat confusing. When I explain the best practices regarding booster seats to parents, many will simply ask me, but what does the law say? And since our present law does not address booster seats, I frequently respond with a comment about the law of physics on your body in a traffic crash, as opposed to any law that might earn the driver a traffic ticket. Updating Minnesota's child safety seat law is not a means to issue more citations, but rather an opportunity to make more parents and caregivers aware of the proper and safest way to restrain children in a motor vehicle. As with almost every traffic law, law enforcement officers always have discretion in enforcement situations. This bill is not an attempt to criminalize parents. It's simply a means to make children safer in cars when parents may not understand the dynamics of a crash. When considering this bill, please remember that present law already requires children in this age group to be buckled up. This proposed change only updates the law and specifies that we buckle up kids in the safest way by using the types of seats that are now commonly and inexpensively available in the marketplace. In addition, any enforcement of this proposed enhancement to the child restraint law would be handled just as the present law is. Our present statute also has specific age requirements, but these have always been handled by officers with a common sense approach and by simply asking parents for any specific information that we may be needed. Parents wouldn't need to worry about having birth certificates to show age or tape measures to show height for the children in their car. In the event that any driver is actually issued a citation for this offense, we still have an option that's already part of our existing child restraint statute for that person to have their ticket dismissed completely if they were to obtain a proper safety or booster seat within 14 days of the ticket being issued. The driver can simply bring the proof of purchase for the seat along with a copy of their ticket to the police station, and the ticket is dismissed. No fine, no record of the citation on the driver's license record. This is handled like many other fix-it tickets that police officers may write for things like a broken windshield or burnt-out headlight. Education and awareness are just as important as enforcement when it comes to the stated goal of traffic safety. A clear and appropriate state statute can help accomplish all of these goals. In a recent traffic crash that I investigated in Lakeville, I was faced with an injured child and the misuse of a child safety seat that contributed to the injuries. During the investigation, the mother of the injured child commented to me repeatedly that she was unsure and confused about what was the best or safest way to buckle up her child. This parent, like so many others, looked to the law as a guide on what is the best or the safest or the most appropriate. By passing this bill, much of the same confusion experienced by other Minnesota parents can be eliminated. In law enforcement, where we deal firsthand with the aftermath of these types of crashes, we hope that Minnesota's elected officials follow the example of 44 other states and strengthen our state's child restraint law. Everyone knows that seatbelts save lives, but a seatbelt that doesn't properly fit will not protect a child in a crash, and booster seats solve this problem. Thank you, Madam.
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Officer O'Neill, you testified that the only thing this would change in law was currently kids have to be buckled up, but this would just require the restraint system. That's what I heard. Is that your testimony?
In the, Madam Representative, the proposal for this law is not going to change that people already have to be buckled up, children in this age group. That's correct. This just specifies that an appropriate child safety seat device be used up until age 8. And in most cases, depending upon
the age of the child is going to be a booster seat. Okay.
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm confused because I thought, and maybe Representative Horton, you can answer the question, that current law only requires up to age 4. Is that correct in terms of
Representative
Horton.
Madam Chair, Representative West, current law requires that a child up to the age of 4 be restrained in a booster seat, but children between the ages of 4 and 11, if they're in a vehicle, be buckled.
Okay, thank you.
Representative
Madam Chair, and Officer O'Neill, you had testified about this being best practices. Would you advocate that other best practices should be codified as mandated in law for other traffic-related items like this?
Officer O'Neill.
Madam, sir, that's kind of a general question talking about a vast variety of things.
Mm-hmm.
I can't simply specify whether all different types of best practices and all different types of motor vehicle situations belong in the law. So, no, I can't say that.
Okay.
Well, just, I mean, I am curious because there are a lot of best practices and we could sort of, you know, just codify all those, but I wondered if this was just in a separate class of itself for some specific reason, but I think you answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative
Horton.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know, you were a member of Police Officers Association here in the state or something to do with law enforcement, am I correct in from that?
Officer O'Neill.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, sir, I am.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Officer O'Neill, I'm calling you representative. You're representative of police officers. Anyway, do you know from your association with police officers or law enforcement what kind of statistics or what kind of data is available to show the benefit of this law in other states?
Officer O'Neill.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, sir, I don't have any hard data or numbers that I can give you here today.
Thank you.
Representative Portman, your last testifier, and then we need to see if anyone is in opposition.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My last testifier is Dr. Helmick.
Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
And Madam Chair, I did want to acknowledge for the members of the committee who might not be aware, it's Pediatricians Day on the Hill, and so a lot of the folks in the audience are pediatricians. If you're wondering why the committee drew a crowd today.
Well, welcome to the committee. Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
My name is Tom Helmick, Madam Chair and Representative. Actually, all came because I was here today. Good afternoon. My name is Tom Helmick, and I'm a pediatric emergency medicine physician at Children's Hospital and Clinic in Minnesota in the Twin Cities. On behalf of the Minnesota Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics and my colleagues in the audience, I'm asking you to please support this bill. We've heard and seen that seatbelts don't fit children properly. From my experience and from a review of evidence-based medical literature, children are sustaining lifelong injuries that are unnecessary. During a crash, when children 4 to 8 years old use a lap belt alone, the body is propelled forward, jackknifing over the lap belt and straining their neck. This can lead to a serious lifelong injury to the back, spinal cord, and internal organs. As we discussed earlier, this is called the seatbelt syndrome. We, and the pediatricians in the audience, could tell you dozens of devastating stories similar to Brynn's. In previous hearings, Dr. Andrew Chiragu, who attended to Brynn while she was at Henson County Medical Center, described Brynn's injuries in detail. He's in the audience today as well. For me, I recall an emotional case of a mother driving her 5-year-old daughter on a short neighborhood trip. The car was hit when a stoplight was run, and unfortunately, her daughter was only in a seatbelt. She sustained an internal injury to her liver and broke her back. What haunts me is a mother crying, saying, "I was only going to the library, only to the library." In addition to the emotional cost of these injuries on children and their families, the cost to the medical system for lifelong injuries is astronomical, yet there are simple, inexpensive solutions. If you recall from times you've taken your children in for a visit to a pediatrician, we've spent a great deal of time educating parents on a number of topics. One is the importance of proper restraint. Today, you can help us by reinforcing the standard of best practice in law. Please do what's best for children's safety. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Dr. Helmick, the question that I have is Do you have any scientific or empirical evidence with you at all that would verify the difference between under 6, under 7, and under 8?
Well, that's a good question. And I don't have that literature, and I can see why you're asking that question. When this law was actually put together, it was looking at what would be for the most reasonable age group, and 8 really fits with the, if you look at the growth curve and stuff, for a child 4'9".
Representative Olin.
Okay, when you refer to looking at the growth curve, can you explain somewhat what you mean exactly, so we...
Well,
Mr. Helmut.
Thank you, Madam. If you look at charts that CHIP, it looks at what is the average for certain age groups, and it's a profile of the population in general. And pediatricians and have these in their offices looking at how CHIP are growing through the years.
Representative Olin.
Is there a specific difference between 8 and 7 or 8 and 6 that you can see?
Mr. Helmut.
Yes, there is.
Representative Olin.
One more question. Is it really predominantly, it's very visible, or is it just are you cutting hairs?
Mr. Helmut.
It is visible. I mean, you think about your own children growing up, there's a difference between a 6-year-old, 7-year-old, 8-year-old. Go to kindergarten classes and elementary school, you'll see those differences easily before you.
One last one.
Representative Olin.
And just to make sure we're on the right age, is there any difference when you get to the age of 9 or under 9?
Again, there is. If you look at the population, then there is a difference.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Helmut, I take it you're a member of the American Medical Association or something like that, of a medical background or medical association you belong to. Do you see in your study or in your report where there are statistics that back up this law being put in place in 34 other states having a demonstrable success as far as it's doing what you're talking about here in this law right now? Other statistics for that?
There is literature out there, or statistics that show the improvements, and even at our trauma centers here, if you look at their data, children who spend a longer time in the intensive care unit or at least stay in a hospital if they were injured and they did not have a booster seat on, as opposed to a booster seat, if they come in and they don't have any kind of a seat belt on or booster seat, they stay longer. If they have only a seat belt on, it's less longer. If they have a booster seat and a seatbelt, they stay less longer in the intensive care unit and length of stay in a hospital, and that's data from our trauma centers, which we've got supplied for you.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Dr. Helmut, so you can show that from the 44 other states that have this law in effect.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm in Minnesota. We have literature from the other states, which we'll be glad to get to you in your hands.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Lett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is Dr. Helmut?
Yes, sir.
Dr. Helmut, I only heard part of the response for Representative Olin, so I'm not sure it was the same question, but it related to if current seatbelts are required for kids up to age 11, why don't we require booster seats all the way up to 11? Was that question already answered? I apologize. So.
Mr. Helmut or Representative Portman, who would like that?
Well, I don't know if the doctor would like to answer, but Representative Lesh, my understanding of the seatbelt law up to age 11, that is not in relationship to protecting somebody during a crash, because the seatbelt protects anybody in a crash. If you have a 17-year-old kid in the back seat, they should be buckled up because their bone structure would indicate they're more likely to survive with a seatbelt on. So I'm not sure that we can extrapolate why that seatbelt requirement was passed for kids up to age 11. I'm sure at the time in the legislature that was some sort of a compromise between buckling all kids up and just going up to a certain age.
Representative Lesh. Well,
thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess this has something to do with the size and height. So up to 4'9", which is written in there. I don't know, maybe there's some big one. Are you 4'9"? Maybe we could require booster seats for Representative Bingham. But I am curious because this is based, I think, on physics, and I would think that the larger they were, I mean, obviously an 8-year-old kid is much smaller, but height may have a difference, but if they weigh more than the average 8-year-old kid, there's going to be more injury without a booster seat. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, I know the doctor has a comment, but Representative Lesh, in the last committee we were in, we brought in a demonstration to show the difference of where on the body the seatbelt fits a child who's under the height of 4 feet 9 inches. And what we're really talking about is bones. And so if you're 4 foot 9 inches and you put on a lap and shoulder restraint, it goes across your hip bones and it connects up at your shoulder bones instead of kind of in your face where a kid would normally put it behind their head. So for this committee here, we're trying to not take the entire committee time. We didn't bring that seatbelt demonstration, but it just shows very clearly the relationship between where your bones are and your height and where the seatbelt fits you.
I actually want to see if there's anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill. Please come to the table and state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm Mary Rarick. I'm a pediatrician down in Owatonna, Minnesota. And I think I can answer some of the questions that have come up. The percentages, Representative Anderson, from my personal practice, I see exactly what people are saying in that they ask me, what is the law? I'll say, are you in a booster seat, Mr. Six-Year-Old? And six-year-old goes, no. And their parents says, well, it's not the law. And if it was the law, they would need to be in a booster seat. And there are some parents out there that, yes, they keep them in a booster seat. My 10-year-old's in a booster seat because she likes it. But if they were required, they would do it. And part of it is pressure. It's peer pressure. It's these kids at school, I don't want to be seen in a booster seat because my friends aren't in a booster seat and I don't want to do it. So their parents may know that it's safe, but they're getting pressure from their kids and the other kids that don't need to be in the booster seat because they're four, or if they're five now, they're out of it. If we said, no, it's safer, you need to be in here till 8, I can guarantee you, my parents would do it, because they say, I have to, honey, it's the law, you need to be in your seat. But they don't, because it's peer pressure, it makes me crazy. So that is one issue. I can tell you, based on personal experience, they would do it if they were required to do it. They know it's safer. But I get that question all the time. So I think from somebody sitting out in rural Minnesota, it is a definite issue, and we know it's safer. I have personal experience with a friend of my daughter's who was in two classes at 8, one in the booster seat, one not in the booster seat. And he told her, oh my gosh, I felt so much better in my booster seat. And that is why she's still in one at 10. It really is a matter of, some of us are very safety conscious, yes, but some of us need that extra guidance. As the question of the height, and the question of the 4 foot nine comes from, where does that hit you? Where does that belt hit you? And I'll tell you, I've had kids in my car that go to put the thing behind their neck, and I say, oh, no way, it's going in front. But it's sitting like this, which bothers me as well. So 4 foot nine is the measure where it needs to come down to here, so it is not in your neck. That's where that comes from. They pick that number because of that, and that gives you an average child of 8. So that is where the age of 8 came from. Now, I have 8-year-olds who are 4'3". And I tell their parents they should be in a booster seat. Why? Because that thing's still hitting them right here. And that's why some still are, but most aren't. So we take the average. That's why we take that. And there is no magic number. I have some 10-year-olds who, there's some adults who should probably still be in booster seats. And there have been deaths from airbags in adults who are 4'10". Okay, we can't cover everybody, but we can cover the average. And so I strongly, strongly advocate, please pass this bill. It's for the safety of the kids, and it's really just guidance for those parents. They want you to back them up.
Thank you. Representative Bingham.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, for one, for the record, I'm 5'1¼". I want to first say I appreciate Representative Wortman's absence issue. Not that we share personal stories here, but when I got my license, I was only 4'9", and I went with my dad, to go take the test. And, I got out of the car, and I'm like, yay, I passed. And he looked at the guy and said, yeah, she's only 4'9". Is there some issue with that?
The guy put an elevated seat restriction on my driver's license. So all I'm saying is that even as adults, there is still some regulation on it, and it was a safety issue. And still to this day, there's a lot of manufacturers when I go, if I buy a car or whatever, some of them do say, hey, watch how close you have your seat up to the steering wheel. And actually, Ford, to my disappointment, stopped with the pedals that came out, too. They stopped that. But anyway, I just thought I'd put that on record that it is also adults do. If your dad opens his mouth when you're getting your driver's license, does affect you on that. So,
Representative Tamar moves that House File 267 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommended referral to the Public Safety Finance Division. Questions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Portman. Next on the agenda is Representative Simon, House File 755. Representative Bingham. Madam Chair, I'll move that House File 755 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance to then have the request to go to Public Safety Finance. Representative Simon, please go ahead, just a moment. Members from the public, as you're leaving the room, if you could please keep it down so we could continue. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's clear there's far less pediatric interest in this bill than in the previous bill. Thank you, members. Thank you, Madam Chair, for scheduling this hearing and for being on the bill as well. I very much appreciate it. Members, this is a bill to combat the phenomenon known as organized retail crime. Those of you on the committee last term, remember we passed this out of this committee last term. It's back in a different and smaller and more simplified form this year, and I'm happy to talk later on about why that is. But, you know, it used to be when it came to shoplifting, that once you stopped or apprehended the shoplifter, that was the end of it. There was no larger conspiracy, usually. There was no larger plan, usually, or any larger sort of organization, usually. But that's not the case anymore. The growth in the last 10 years of online auction sites such as eBay has made it a lot easier for people to use those sites and others like them as electronic fencing operations. And as a result, we've seen an explosion nationwide, and Minnesota is no exception, in what's known as organized retail crime. If you go to the FBI website right now on their homepage, there's links to information about organized retail crime. You should have some handouts that are either at your desk or on your way around that demonstrate the scope of the problem. And in Minnesota alone, we lose about $41 million per year in sales taxes. So that's 6.5% of the problem, at least as of a couple of years ago, about what we lose. I'd like to do as little talking as possible and hand it over to those who face this problem every day who can explain to you why this is different than just the teenager who sticks a CD in his or her vest or makes out the grocery store with an expensive item. This is real, this is big, and I think it demands our attention.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Carol Martinson, and I have copies of testimony here if anyone would like. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Carol Martinson. I'm the Vice President of Asset Protection Group at SuperValue and have been in the security and asset protection arena for over 30 years. I'm pleased to be here today to testify in support of House File 755, which will add another tool for law enforcement and our loss prevention teams to aid in the prosecution of theft and organized retail crime at our stores. SuperValue is the third largest publicly held company based on revenue headquartered in Minnesota. Nationally, we operate over 2,500 stores, 923 pharmacies, 124 fuel centers, and 35 distribution centers. SuperValue supplies over 5,000 grocery retail endpoints and operates in 48 states. We employ over 190,000 people, including 120,000 union members. In Minnesota, we operate Cub Foods, Hornbacher's, and Save-A-Lot, the majority of our corporate business at Cub Foods. We also provide wholesale grocery deliveries and support to many other food retailers in the state, to name a few: Lunds and Byerly's, Kowalski's, Colburn's, as well as the local SuperValue stores that many of us grew up with in Minnesota. Theft and organized retail crime are pervasive issues for our company and the food industry. We take theft on any level very seriously, and our experience with organized retail crime has been significant, especially on the West Coast, where leaders of organized retail crime have been connected to international terrorist groups, South American crime consortiums, and other highly organized criminal enterprises. The same connections exist in this state as well. Our stolen products, such as baby formula, so maybe those pediatricians would be interested, razors, teeth whitening strips, and over-the-counter medications go from the hand of boosters, dispensing operations, where they may be sold to pawn shops, be sold online in such arenas as eBay or Craigslist, or show up at flea markets. They also may show up at other smaller retail stores and convenience shops, and those owners may or may not know that it's stolen. Theft and organized retail crime costs our company tens of millions of dollars each year, and in Minnesota at Cub Foods we estimate anywhere from $2 to $5 million a year. Our customers end up paying for these thefts through higher prices and inconveniences, such as keeping baby formula and other high-risk products behind lock cases. In Minnesota, we recently caught two women at Cub Store with $2,800 worth of baby formula taken from several stores. They were arrested stealing $800 worth of formula in our store, and when police searched their vehicle, they had another 158 cans in the trunk. These suspects were known to all retailers in the area and were the target of a property task force investigation in the South Metro area. Our $2,800 loss was just a small part of the total loss related to these suspects. And losses like this are not uncommon. Theft and organized retail crime is on the rise. In 2007, Cub Foods had 1,931 apprehensions, and in 2008, during the same period, 2,217, about a 15% increase. Similarly, the average amount we recover from each apprehension has also risen about 15%, due largely to some of the organized cases. We've seen an increase in the market for baby formula theft in this economy, presumably to meet the growing demand of people looking for low prices in a tough economy and turning to less conventional outlets to find a deal. Purchasing formula from unknown suppliers becomes a serious food safety issue as well. When we lose control of a product, such as baby formula, we have no idea if expiration dates have been tampered with or if the product has been exposed to temperatures or other factors that would compromise the quality of the product. While the soldiers of organized retail crimes openly carry out the trade in Minnesota retail businesses, they also are beginning to invade the supply chain as well. A few years ago, one of our distribution centers suffered a loss of $250,000 in stolen baby formula in a short period of time. Once you begin to see the pictures of how large the losses are, there is no doubt that this is truly an organized criminal enterprise in every sense of the meaning. We also see many cases of repeat offenders, whether it's product theft, or using fraudulent financial instruments to obtain and resell products. Just this past weekend, our Cub Foods loss prevention team, in conjunction with area law enforcement, was able to orchestrate the arrest of a person that I have known since my early days in the security profession. If you remember, I said I've been in this business for 30 years. This is a repeat professional criminal who's gone from stolen check fraud early in his criminal career to the more recent phenomena of identity theft, which has facilitated his involvement in check, credit, and gift card fraud. We are supporting ORC, or organized retail crime legislation at the federal level, as well as in many other states. As laws on the West and East Coast become stricter on organized retail crime, offenders will migrate to markets where the laws are more lenient. We support this legislation as an important step that will give retailers, law enforcement, and prosecutors a tool to appropriately prosecute organized retail crime. Thank you.
Questions from members. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, what if we have this law in effect right now? Are there results to show that it's been effective, and have you got comments on that?
Representative Simon?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. You know, I can't remember anymore how many states have passed it. Several. Many states have passed it. I'll try to get that information. I think some of the law enforcement folks who are going to come up have something to say about that, and I know, Madam Chair, in the interest of time, we're going to get things rolling here. I know you have at least one other bill. I just wanted to say as a segue before I introduce him, you're going to hear now from Paul Ostenson from Target, and I went out and visited, as I know others have, the Target security facility out, I think it's in Brooklyn Park, and what you see there is really amazing. And you see what some of these schemes are. You can see what's depicted in front of you. These are organized groups and cells and theft rings that move from store to store, sometimes city to city,
And they do things like, for example, they'll send four guys into a store, same build, all wearing white t-shirts and jeans to sort of confuse the security cameras. Or they'll go in and report a four-year-old child missing to distract the security cameras, and they'll make up with a bunch of iPods. And this is at Target or Best Buy or whatever. These are sophisticated people. And in one case that I know of, people actually drilled into the store roof. It's like out of a Tom Cruise movie, drilled in through in a Best Buy store, shimmied down and stole a bunch of high-priced merchandise and made off with tens of thousands of dollars. So this is serious stuff. Like I said, it's not the teenager who's making off with music.
Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Paul Austinson. Madam Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Paul Austinson. I work in investigations for Trucker Corporation here in Minneapolis, Minnesota. My background includes e-fencing investigations and also traditional brick-and-mortar fencing locations like the example that we have down here in front of us, but businesses that are knowingly buying stolen merchandise. Thank you for having me here in your time. Organized retail crime is one of the most pressing security problems facing the retail industry today, accounting for tens of billions of dollars in losses every year. This is more than burglary, larceny, robbery, and auto theft combined. Different than shoplifting, organized retail crime is typically a large-scale operation involving individuals and teams, sophisticated, well-connected criminals with specific roles who steal products and sell them for significant profits. Organized retail crime is damaging on several levels. It costs retailers, consumers, and communities through lost tax revenue, and this lost revenue is especially concerning in challenging economic times we have today. The enormous profits have also fueled criminal activity hurting our community. At Target, we take many steps in preventing theft, but unfortunately we can't prevent all crime that takes place because of organized criminal operations that either sell to traditional brick-and-mortar fences and or online to the general public. It's growing rapidly, and even profitability of selling goods online has become even more of an appetite or a location for stolen merchandise to go. I want to jump right into the case example that you have in front of you. This is a three-year investigation that we conducted at Target in conjunction with other retailers. There was roughly 150 shoplifters that were identified that were impacting Target and other retailers that sell DVD movies. Boosters were stealing anywhere from 10 to 100 movies at a time. One method that they would use to get it out of the business would be a booster bag like this, which is a foil-lined bag. And that would defeat the alarms on the merchandise itself and also the alarms at the doors. There were two fencing locations or businesses that were identified in the investigation, and through the partnership with local law enforcement and also federal law enforcement, we were able to execute search warrants on the business after a lengthy investigation. Through the course of the investigation, we identified six cells that were stealing DVD movies from our stores and other retailers, and were selling it to this location for anywhere from 10 cents to 25 cents on the dollar, the retail dollar that's listed at the store. At the conclusion of the investigation, we were able to identify the total value associated with the retail theft as being anywhere from $7 million to $17 million at this one location here in front of us. Since healthy communities and healthy businesses go hand in hand, crimes against our businesses ultimately harm the safety and security of our communities and the residents. At Target, we've invested heavily in combating organized retail crime, whether it be at the store level, at our investigation center, the one that Representative Simon referenced in Brooklyn Park, and also located throughout the country. We also have two forensics labs that we operate for our cases and also in partnership with law enforcement. The key to solving organized retail crime is a collaborative legislative solution supported by law enforcement. The bill that Representative Simon is introducing today will go a long way in meeting this need by simply adding felony theft to the racketeering statute, a statute which combats organized crime. This will help law enforcement focus its resources where they're needed most, on the criminal ringleaders who engage in organized retail crime for a living and coordinate the involvement of other criminals. This legislation is essentially provides new tools for law enforcement to maximize their resources. Businesses have a social and ethical responsibility to proactively find solutions for crime in our communities. We persistently strive to prevent organized retail crime before it happens, but improving safety and security of our communities, we are confident that through federal and state legislation will effectively combine with retailers and law enforcement efforts. I appreciate your time, and if you have any questions, I'll answer them.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now that members have, I hope, a little bit of a sense of the scope of the problem, I think the question now is, well, what is the solution? And just by way of background, and those of you who are here on this committee or Representative Paymar's committee last time know that what happened last year, or last term, I think it was, is we We passed the bill out of here. It was a much different kind of bill then. We ran into some resistance in Representative Haymar's committee, where there was a real reluctance to create some new felonies. We had multiple new felonies that we were creating, and Representative Holberg in particular, I remember, and something that really resonated among committee members, she said, look, do we really want to go after the dumb kid? She kept referring to the dumb kid who disables, whether intentionally or not, even if intentionally, disables an anti-theft device and so forth. So we were instructed by Representative Haymar and others to go back to the drawing board, which we did. And over this last summer and fall, we met three or four times in a very large group at a ridiculously large conference table, I can assure you. Didn't know they made tables that big. And we had the defense bar there. We had state and local and federal law enforcement. In fact, among federal law enforcement, we had prosecutors and folks from the Postal Service there as well. Obviously, we had the retailers, the grocers, and others. And the person you're about to hear from, if he could come on down, is the one who really came up with the idea. I think he deserves most of the credit. He's on the front lines of these offenses. He's a prosecutor with Hennepin County, and he'll tell you about the proposed solution this year. I think most people, at least, acknowledge this is a problem, and we ought to be doing something and treating this differently than regular old shoplifting. And the question is, how do we handle it, and how do we do it while being sensitive to the concerns that we heard last year? So I'd like to introduce to you Tom Arneson of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tom Arneson. I'm a senior assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I have the property crime prosecution unit of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. As Representative Simon had indicated, we've worked this summer and fall on this legislation with business groups, retailers, the County Attorney's Association, law enforcement, and other groups in drafting what are really narrow and targeted changes in legislation to deal with this issue. This bill makes two narrow changes to existing statutes. The first provision fills what I think is a small gap in the theft statutes. The penalties for theft are based primarily on value, and in most instances, in order to make something a felony, the value has to be over $1,000. The theft statutes currently provide for a lower dollar value threshold to make theft a felony offense if a person has certain prior felony or gross misdemeanor convictions for theft or theft-related offenses. For instance, if a person has a prior gross misdemeanor or a felony conviction for forgery, financial transaction card fraud, burglary, robbery, and certain other enumerated crimes, the dollar value threshold for felony prosecution is only $500 as compared to $1,000. Under existing law, a prior conviction for identity theft is not among the list of offenses that could qualify for this enhancement. However, most identity theft offenses actually involve some type of forgery, financial transaction card fraud, or forgery. And in fact is considered to be a more serious offense than these other crimes. However, under the statute, identity theft is not an offense that allows for enhancement. I think that is probably the case because the identity theft statute was passed in 1999 after these enhancement provisions were already in place. Oftentimes, prosecutors will charge or seek a conviction for identity theft as opposed to one of the other convictions of theft, forgery, financial transaction, card fraud. But under the statute, that will not allow for subsequent enhancement. So frankly, this piece of the amendment really, I think, corrects an anomaly in the current theft sentencing provision. The second provision in this legislation gets at the organized retail crime, and it's aimed at fighting sophisticated theft in shoplifting rings, and it uses the existing RICO or racketeering statute. Under Minnesota law, the racketeering statute already punishes people who commit a pattern of criminal activity as part of an organized group or part of an enterprise. What this legislation does is it adds felony theft to the list of the, what I'll call, predicate offenses that are necessary to prove that pattern of criminal activity under the racketeering statute. The racketeering statute currently lists the predicate crimes that can be used to show that pattern of criminal activity. And currently, felony violations of approximately 50 different criminal statutes under Minnesota law constitute these predicate offenses. However, plain old theft, that is, taking something from another without their permission, is not one of those offenses, while other types of felony theft are. For instance, motor vehicle theft, felony theft by swindle, theft of a controlled substance, are among that list of some 50 crimes that fall within the RICO statute. So what this statute does is it gets at the organized retail crime, which it includes the shoplifting, by adding that general theft provision for felony theft to the RICO statute. It uses existing Minnesota law that's there to fight organized crime, to deal with this new and different type of organized crime that is affecting our retailers. Under Minnesota law, the racketeering violations are not ranked under the Minnesota guidelines. It is up to the sentencing judge to determine what the appropriate ranking is, and thus that would affect what the ultimate sentence would be, whether it would be a presumptive probationary sentence or whether it is a presumptive commit offense. And I think what this allows is for the court to look at the severity of the conduct and treat the people in different places in the organized crime hierarchy with the appropriate level of punishment.
Excuse me, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This might be for all your testifiers, if you're assigned, but what evidence do you have to show that by putting the identity theft thing in will actually make a definite success rate ratio as far as bringing back in? And what categories of identity theft are going to be added to this new statute along with it?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, the identity theft provision is limited only to enhancing a theft. So if you have a prior conviction for a prior felony or gross conviction for identity theft, that would allow felony prosecution for a subsequent theft where the value taken is $500 as opposed to $1,000. So it is in some ways a distinct provision from the racketeering statute.
Representative Anderson, a follow-up? Representative Tamar.
I have a follow-up to that then. So let's say you're a 19-year-old and you forged an ID card, and then 3 years down the line you got arrested for shoplifting something exceeding $500. Am I correct then that this person could be charged with a felony under these new statutory changes?
Mr. Aronson?
Madam Chair and Representative Paymar, under the first provision of the bill, that is correct. Although what I would note is that under your hypothetical, that person also may have committed a forgery, either an aggravated forgery or a forgery under Minnesota law, and if they were charged with that as opposed to identity theft, then under current law, they would be subject to an enhancement.
Okay. However, I didn't ask that. I see that aggravated forgery is under here. I'm just asking if someone was charged with identity theft under the new statute and then shoplifted an item over $500 3 years later, could this individual be charged with a felony?
Yes, if they were convicted of a... if they received a gross misdemeanor or felony sentence as a result of that identity theft.
So sometime, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. So at some point, Representative Simon, maybe you could walk through the bill and just go back to Representative Fulbert's dumb kid analogy that we had last year. And just, I know we were criticized for using the word dumb kid, but it was public record. So we'll just maybe you can just say how is your bill avoiding and trapping about those kids?
Representative.
At some point, you don't have to. You don't have to do it now, but okay. At some point before your testimony is over.
Representative Anderson also has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Simon was going to answer, and I missed the answer to the question I asked him, so I wanted to have him respond to my. And also, because in the handout here, it shows that there are different stores across the nation that are affected. I was going to ask Cub or Target what their results were or what their feelings were from other states as to if this law has an effect there and what they saw for results that would help us here in the state of Minnesota. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, I think of your question as a two-part question. First, will it deter people from doing this in the first place? That I don't know. And I think that's always speculative. We don't know if someone's going to learn about or know about laws on the books and say, well, I ought not to be in that business. But if you're asking, will it allow law enforcement, as I understand it, to go after the real perpetrators, not, you know, to use the language of the drug trade, not just the mules that go into the store, but really get at the larger enterprise, then what I'm hearing loudly and clearly from law enforcement on a local, state, and multiple federal levels is yes, it will. And if they don't feel that they have those tools now under Minnesota law.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, do you have specific testimony to that effect from like Cub and those people from their national stores?
Representative Simon.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to hand it over to any of the retail folks now who want to speak to experience in other states, but I know that they've been happy with those other efforts too. Part of the problem too in getting some of the statistics is that these are very new laws, some of them in the last year or so. So it's hard to measure their actual impact at yet, at least that's what I'm told. But if any of the retailers here want to talk about specific experiences in other states, that might be helpful.
I just want to see if there's anyone in the audience that wanted to testify for or against this bill other than the testifiers, because we want to make sure we have adequate time to wrap this up. Okay. So why don't you come and answer the question and we'll call for the public testimony. Whoever has their cell phone on, if you could please turn it off. It's interfering with the tape.
Phil Martin, Madam Chair. The state of California has some legislation that's been evolving over the last 3 to 4 years, and we have found by using that legislation that we are able to aggregate cases and put them together and prosecute them differently than we've been able to in the past. And partially because, you know, you always have multiple municipalities, multiple counties with different jurisdictions. So when you can start looking at going after the people who are making the money on this, the true money, it always goes back to who's making the money on it. If you are able to get bigger cases, get better sentences, and move it up from a state and into federal legislation and prosecution. So we have found, it's still new, but we have found that it is helping us with bigger cases and better results from a prosecution standpoint.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Didn't get your first thing. Mr. Martinson, if you could give me some data on just what you've found in California or any other data that might be available, Representative Simon, that'd be great.
Thank you. All right. Please come to the table and state your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Jamie Poole, Madam Chair. Thank you. My name is Jamie Poole, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Grocers Association. The Minnesota Grocers Association is a trade association representing over 1,300 food retailers, distributors, and manufacturers. Our member companies employ over 85,000 union and non-union Minnesotans. The Minnesota Grocers Association is in support of this bill. We have been each received a letter that we have in support of this. Organized retail crime is the most serious security problem facing the retail community, costing as much as $30 billion annually per FBI estimates. These crimes ultimately lead to inflated prices for consumers and lost sales tax revenue for the state. The MGA works closely with their local law enforcement to put the appropriate measures in place to reduce risk and create safer shopping experiences as well as extensive in-house training and education of its staff. But it is simply not enough to combat problems of this magnitude. I'll keep it brief. So in closing, the Minnesota Grocers Association believes this community can be a great service to Minnesotans by supporting this legislation but recognizes organized retail crime and assigns appropriate penalties for the severe nature of this. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I do stand for questions.
Thank you. Go ahead. State your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Buzz Anderson. I'm president of the Minnesota Retailers Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and thanks for the indulgence of the chair and the committee on this issue. I will be very brief. I passed out a letter of support from our association. The Minnesota Retailers Association strongly supports this legislation. Enough said. I also want to say, however, that we want to thank Representative Simon for reaching out to the retail community, to law enforcement, prosecutors, the defense bar, and to the Financial Crime Task Force in helping to forge this solution. I will also say, Madam Chair, that I will be happy to provide answers to Representative Anderson and to the committee as it relates to success in other states. I'll ask my counterparts in other states and also the National Retail Federation and the Retail Industry Leaders Association for some feedback, and I'll get that to you as soon as possible.
Thank you. Representative Simon, closing comments.
Only that I respectfully ask for your support, members, for the bill. This is a retooled, reshaped bill. And yes, Representative Paymar, you wanted me to answer. Well, you know, I can't, I think your question was sort of a dumb kid question now that we've got that term out there. You know, as to the racketeering piece, I don't know that that's that much of an issue, but as to the identity theft piece, you know, is it possible that someone will get, you know, snared in this net? Sure, it is possible, but as with all of these kinds of bills, we really do rely on prosecutorial discretion, and I think as with any bill before the legislature, you have to weigh the good and the bad. Is there a possibility of a disadvantage? Sure. But I think that's greatly outweighed by the scope of the problem and the need for us to do something. I really need to emphasize this is no longer about the kid throwing a CD in his vest. This is about a vast criminal enterprise. And the law enforcement folks that I've talked to think this is something that we really do need.
Representative Hamer, follow up.
What is the motion?
The motion is
to go to your
send
committee.
It to finance to send it to your committee. Is that fine, Representative Hamer?
Yes.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, I was just reading the identity theft statute, and it looks under C that if I'm on the board of a neighborhood association, we have little cards, and I'm no longer on it, and I give that out to somebody, that triggers this, and then if I steal something, I'm suddenly into this racketeering, it looks to me.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mullery, you know, we could all spin out a lot of hypotheticals here. That's the current law that you're talking about right now. That's true. And if that law needs changing, maybe that law needs changing. You know, frankly, we rely on prosecutorial discretion, as Representative Lesch well knows. And my strong suspicion would be that the hypothetical that you talk about is not one that we probably have to worry about. I'm glad you raised it. But I just, we're not here to redo that particular statute. But I'd rather have an expert really talk about that.
Well, Madam Chair, just kind of a comment. I don't think it's in the present statute there, but it's not in the new. It doesn't increase it right now as you're doing so.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery.
Great.
The identity theft is actually a more serious crime than other provisions, than other crimes that are now included in crimes that will enhance a theft.
Follow-up, Representative Mullery?
No, Madam Chair.
All right. Other questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Bingham renews her motion that House File 755 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommended referral to the Public Safety Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simon. Next, we have House File 668. I will move that House File 668 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division. Representative Morrow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this is a bill involving post crash inspections involving school buses. Right now, there's two standards for post crash inspections. One involves commercial vehicles, the other involves school buses. The Department of Public Safety and the State Patrol came and he asked me to carry this bill. Here's a bill that would coordinate the investigations of large vehicle inspections. And Madam Chair, I'd like to turn to Lieutenant Carroll from the State Patrol to explain a little bit more about this bill.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Committee, Edward Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L. With this language today, bringing it forward, this language will bring school bus post crash requirements in line with existing commercial vehicle post crash requirements. Right now, there's two, and it's very confusing to law enforcement personnel. In addition, this proposal will align Minnesota state statute with current definition of reportable crash established by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. By more clearly defining post-crash inspection criteria for law enforcement personnel, resulting change will increase efficiency by minimizing unnecessary responses by emergency personnel for post-crash inspections. The language change will more clearly define the statutory requirements for school bus post-crash inspection. The resulting change will increase the number of post-crash inspections conducted, giving the Department of Public Safety a clear snapshot of private carrier or school district overall bus operations. Resulting inspections will ensure a more accurate reporting of data elements on the state accident report by quickly identifying trends through collection of data elements for the Department of Public Safety and the State Patrol. We can be more accurate, we can be more proactive in ensuring compliance with state laws and addressing items identified in the report. Also, this language change will coincide with the future updates to the proposed State of Minnesota Accident Report. It also will improve State Patrol working relationship with other law enforcement industry partners and improve efficient services.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, this is just a technical question. Did you say that you just wanted the transportation policy, or were you going to send this bill?
Representative Anderson, this needs to go to Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division.
Thank Representative you. Anderson. There's too many words. Transportation policy, just, that cuts it to the dry, so
right.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. Mm-hmm. Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, Gary Bostic for the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. Our organization represents about 60% of the kids that are transported to and from each day, the private sector cluster, and Representative Morrow brought this to our attention. I'm still playing it back to our members, but to date I've heard no opposition. That number seems very old and archaic as far as a triggering mechanism, and as Mr. Carroll mentioned, this is, ties it consistently with the commercial reporting, so it makes a lot of sense. So if we do have any concerns, we'll raise them in the next committee, but to date it looks like a very good a logical change, and we would support it at this point.
All right. I would renew my motion that House File 668 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passed. Thank you,
Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Members, I would move that House File 509 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it go to the Public Safety Finance Division. Madam Chair, members, with me is the Public Defender, and we're actually going to delete a section of the bill right off the bat. Section 2 was brought to my attention that Section 2 of the bill may impact pending legislation, and it is the policy of the House not to interfere with pending legislation, so I would move that Section 2 be deleted from the bill. Any comments from the members or questions of members on the amendment?
Can you clarify, I'm sorry, Representative Hillstrom, can you clarify again, too, it's the policy
not to interfere with what? Is this like a prime directive?
Pending litigation, usually on the floor of the House. People stand up and say, this will impact pending legislation.
Prime directive for you Trekkies out there.
Thank you. So it is a deletion of Section 2, which is on line 1.17 to line through 1.23, Madam Chair. Any other questions from members? See none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you.
Please, go ahead. Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Cutter. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. What you have before you is a bill that we've talked to a number of you about to get at a couple of issues relative to eligibility and also public defender reimbursement. And then, Chair, with your permission, I guess we'd just go through it section by section and talk a little bit about each of those. Madam Chair and members, Section 1, the first change, would conform the statutes to a Supreme Court decision in the case of State v. Johnson. That's on line 1.13, where the defendant's consent to a certification as a petty misdemeanor is required. The statute currently says it's not required, but the court has already ruled that it is. The second change in Section 1 says that if, in fact, a misdemeanor is certified as a petty, the defendant would not be eligible for a public defender. If there's no jail time attached, then the person would not be eligible. As the author has indicated, Section 2 has been deleted. Section 3 begins the issue of eligibility. And what we're talking about here is not expanding or, for that matter, frankly, significantly contracting eligibility, but trying to give the judges some guidelines, make it more consistent across the state, and direct the statute at the individual or the client rather than at the people that are in the household. And if you look on lines 2.6 and 2.7, the language that we are proposing to delete, the current law says the defendant or any dependent of the defendant who resides in the same household receives means-tested government benefits. What we are doing there is trying to replace that language with language on somebody's income and prorate that based on the severity of a crime. I think we've all talked in here on numerous occasions about the cost or the of defending oneself against a misdemeanor versus a felony, for example. So what we are proposing is a income threshold of 150% for a misdemeanor, 175% of the federal poverty guidelines for a gross misdemeanor, and 200% of the felony of the poverty guidelines for a felony. Then, Chair and members, Section 4 deals with updating the statute on the appointment of a public defender, primarily in the appeals area. If you look on page 4, line 4.2, the chief appellate defender is the actual person who deals with these issues, not the state public defender. Lines 4.4 through 4.9, the language that's being proposed to be deleted. Again, the issue of conflicts, which this addresses, is really dealt with at the local level by the chief public defender, not by the state public defender. Those appointments are run through those district offices. Madam Chair, Section 5 on reimbursements, as we testified, I don't know if it was in this committee or Representative Paymars, currently there is a reimbursement statute where the court can order reimbursement of public defender expenses. Those reimbursements go to part-time public defenders to offset their overhead costs, because we don't pay for their offices, we don't pay for their secretaries, we don't pay for any of those items. In the 1st Judicial District, Hennepin County, we do not have any part-time state employees that qualify for that. This was an attempt to try to at least recognize that the county makes a significant contribution to that office in a way of recouping at least some of that money for the county. Madam Chair and members, in Section 6, again on reimbursements, in this area, we're proposing to change the shall to a may. There are judges out there who feel compelled to order reimbursement, and so there are some instances where somebody may not qualify, but then they are appointed a public defender, and then the court is ordering that reimbursement. What we're trying to do is give the court some flexibility here and hopefully have those folks appointed private counsel rather than a public defender. Again, the last section there, the language that we're striking, is to have the court not look at a grid or a chart, if you will, that's in Section 7 that's being repealed or proposed to be repealed, which currently they don't do anyway, but instead look at the original eligibility application. Again, that chart that's being repealed and the language that's being proposed to be stricken really isn't being used. And so if you have the eligibility guidelines, if you have the eligibility application, and that's where the assets or the income is located, then that ought to be the thing that drives whether or not somebody provides your reimbursement. So very quickly, that is the bill.
How will this affect your caseload and to your budget?
Madam Chair and members, we don't expect that this is going to impact it a great deal. I think, as I said, it's going to give the judges some solid guidelines. It's going to give them some consistency, hopefully across the state. In Dakota County, they're using a similar thing right now. Seems to be working pretty well for them. Theirs is a little bit more involved, or at least it has been. So, again, it's kind of addressed the consistency issue.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding to your repealer on Minnesota Statute 2008, Section 611, it sounds like that you're saying that it's not being used or it's not valuable. On what premise or what basis are you got to state that?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, we've talked to all of our chief district public defenders around the state, and they don't recall this particular chart being used. Typically, and if you remember from either last year or 2 years ago, there was actually a $40 per hour guideline in the statute, and again was one of those ones which weren't being used because on a number of occasions the judges were looking at the eligibility application. So what we're saying is let's take out the confusion and say the eligibility application is where all of the income and assets should be disclosed, and that ought to be the driving force on reimbursement as well.
Representative Lex.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kyer, first question is you've taken out the not language in subdivision 1 on line 1.13. Can you explain to that why your position is on why you need that again?
Sure. Okay.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, the court has already ruled on that and that the consent of the defendant is required. So that's merely updating the statute to reflect that Supreme Court decision. That's State v. Johnson.
Okay, and Madam Chair, Mr. Kyer, what was State v. Johnson? What year was that?
94, 95.
Okay, so we're just getting around to it in 2009. That's timely. Although I would just say for the record, I don't think it's really necessary that the legislature changes all of our laws to reflect what the Supreme Court says. We are two separate branches of government. So my next question, if I may, Madam Chair, is, Mr. Kyer, can you tell me, what is 200% of the federal poverty guidelines in Minnesota? If I live here in the Twin Cities and have two kids, what am I making?
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, if you have two, So a household of four, the poverty guideline is $22,000, so 200%, $44,000, a little over $44,000.
Okay, so I can, as I understand it, I can make $44,000 a year in that situation, Madam Chair, Mr. Kier, and I get a free public defender. That's for a felony, right?
Correct.
Madam Chair and Mr. Kier, why the different levels for misdemeanor, gross, and felony?
Madam Chair and Representative Lesch, the different levels were to try to reflect the different cost of or that it would take for somebody to go out in the private sector and hire a lawyer. Obviously, a misdemeanor case is going to cost you a lot less than a felony case to defend yourself.
Okay. And I just do, if I may, Madam Chair, I have one more question, but before that, a comment. Mr. Kier, you and I have had this conversation before, but considering that the public defender in Minnesota handles 90% of all serious criminal matters, it would seem that our decisions on income criteria are substantially affecting the price of the private market and what it's going to cost you based on the availability of private defense counsel to take your case, when chances are pretty good already that you're going to get a free lawyer at least 9 out of 10 times. So I think that's something that maybe this committee should look at in the future. My last question, if I may, Madam Chair, is...
Representative Lesch, you just have to take two other questions. We are over the committee time, and the staff for the next committee hearing is coming in.
Okay. Mr. Kier, it seems like in Section 6, we're going the opposite direction in taking out the shall and the may. Taking the shall and changing it to may. Why are we going the opposite direction in allowing courts to then pay for public defenders that they otherwise wouldn't?
Madam Chair and Representative Lesch, I think what we're trying to get at is that the judges who then make that appointment then feel obligated or have the shall in there to then order that reimbursement. What we prefer them to do is not appoint the public defender to begin with if, in fact, somebody doesn't qualify. So...
Representative Paymer.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll wait for the next committee.
Representative Anderson.
Oh, Madam Chair, I guess this is for the Finance Committee because I was just wondering what the savings were on this bill and if it's going to actually give the state and sort of a better financial status.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Wilson renews her motion that House File 509 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation referral to the Public Safety Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Real quick, members, we do have to approve the minutes for the February 17th meeting. Can I get a motion? Representative Kelly moves the minutes be approved for February 17th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Committee is now adjourned.